The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Good evening, afternoon. My name is Justin Hughes, and I'm here to talk to you today on the topic, Bring It, Don't Dumb It Down, How to Teach a 12-Year-Old a Classic. Let's begin with prayer. Our Father, we thank you for the task that you've given us to teach. We take it very seriously, and we ask you to give us wisdom, insight, knowledge as we do it, and I pray that our discussion here today would be profitable for that. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen. As I said, I'm Justin Hughes. I teach at Trinitas Christian School in Pensacola, Florida. I've done that for 6 of the last 8 years. And what I have to say today is nothing that I would consider profound. It's simply a collection of some of the lessons I've learned the hard way. And so if you've been doing this for 15 or 20 or 30 years, I'm sorry. I'm kidding. Good for you. Perhaps we should trade places. I would be delighted to hear what you have to say. Before I earnestly begin the things that I do have to say, I have a couple of preliminaries that I'd like to ask of you. One thing that I say to my class often throughout the year is that with their parents' tuition payment comes what I call a heresy insurance policy. That is, the classroom is a workshop. It's a place where we get to run around and explore all kinds of ideas. And chances are, if we're brave and if we are really exploring and we're really chasing ideas to all sorts of ends, chances are we're going to say something or think something that needs to be corrected. And the classroom is a safe place. I want you to feel free to chase. And if you tread on some heretical ice, don't worry, I'm here to protect you. And so I would ask the same of you. I would ask you today to offer me a policy of offense insurance, because when I speak from a manuscript, I am able to think through everything I want to say carefully, but when I speak from talking points like I will today, I know I'm probably going to offend most of you at least 4 times. So please grant me offense insurance. Bear with me and forgive me. And if I need to qualify something, I would be glad to do that. Also, please forgive my contrariness. I'm going to say a few things today that tend to maybe go against some of the things that you and I have been taught. I really don't think they're truly contrary, though. I just like to take that attitude because it's kind of fun sometimes. And then lastly on the preliminaries list is, let's not save our questions for the end of the talk today. With this kind of talk, I feel like if we are saving up questions for the end, number one, you're going to forget a good question that you had somewhere along the way. And number two, it'll be completely out of context by the end, and I think it would be much better if we stop where we are, talk about something within the context of whatever I've just said. So please, if you have questions, if you'd like for me to clarify something, if you'd like to take issue with something I say, please raise your hand, and I'll find a point to pause, and I'd love to deal with it in the moment. Okay? Thank you very much, and with that, we begin. Bring It, Don't Dumb It Down, How to Teach a 12-Year-Old a Classic. Several of you probably are in literature programs where you don't have the problem of teaching 12-year-olds classics. Maybe you have a classics literature class that you offer in the 11th grade. But a lot of you, I'm guessing, are probably in programs that do sort of an integrated program in the Veritas omnibus model, where you are teaching literature and history, philosophy, theology all together. And you're doing that in the dialectic stage, you're doing it in the rhetoric stage, and so chances are you're having to teach some pretty weighty material to very young students. That's what I'm here to talk about today. If you don't teach 12-year-olds classics, I'm not here arguing that you ought to teach 12-year-olds classics. I'm here to say if we have to teach 12-year-olds classics, and I think it's good to, I don't think it's the only way, I think it's good to, let's consider how to do it best. So why is it worth the trouble? Why do we bother to teach 12-year-olds classics? I want to quote Sayers here from the education essay that's appended to Wilson's book, The Lost Tools of Learning, Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning. I guess the essay is called The Lost Tools of Learning. But bear with me here, and I'll read from Sayers. Medieval education concentrated on first forging and learning to handle the tools of learning, using whatever subject came handy as a piece of material on which to doodle until the use of the tool became second nature. Then later in the essay, she writes, "The contents of the syllabus at this stage may be anything you like. The subjects supply material, but they are all to be regarded as mere grist for the mental mill to work upon." In other words, this is Sayers. In other words, anything will do for a subject. What we're interested in is that students simply learn the tools for learning. Here's where my contrariness comes in. If that's the case, why have we picked these books? If anything will do for grist for the mental mill that we're running, why are we not watching Disney princess films in our classes and doing logical exercises with them? That's not what we're doing, right? And so certainly I do think that the dialectic stage is very much about these mental exercises and running grist for the mill. But if we're going to be running grist for the mill, oughtn't we use good grist, right? And I would suppose that that you're of the same mind. And here, I'm not disagreeing with Sayers. I'm not saying that it's not important to teach dialectic skills, because that's certainly what we have to do. But we can't do that like Plato would have us, off in some heaven with ideal dialectic skills that have no substance to them, right? We have to have substance to teach dialectic skills. And so, let's get good substance. If we need something to master the grammar of and something to argue about, we ought to use good stuff. And so the fact of the matter is that we've chosen these books because we believe there to be something good about them. We apparently think it matters that our students know about the anger of Peleus' son Achilles and its devastation, which put pains thousandfold upon the Achaeans, hurled in their multitudes to the house of Hades' strong souls of heroes, but gave their bodies to be the delicate feasting of dogs, of all birds, and the will of Zeus was accomplished since that time when first there stood in division of conflict Atreus' son, the lord of men, and brilliant Achilles. That's good, isn't it? That's no Disney princess. There is a princess in the Iliad, several of them, as a matter of fact, but not in the style of Disney. So we must be teaching these books for a reason. You've chosen the Iliad or the Odyssey or Herodotus, or you've chosen Aeschylus or Sophocles or Plato. You've chosen these books that you're reading for a reason. And so because you've chosen those books and because I've chosen the ones I have and our boards have given us these lists, we must really believe that the task of our education is about more than just the tools of learning, right? It has to be more about more than just the tools of learning. So let me offer a few suggestions for why we want to read the classics. And I'll briefly go through those. Entrance into the great conversation. Whether we want to read a book that was written in the Middle Ages, or a good book that was written in the early modern period, or a good book that was written last week, chances are, in order to be really conversant in whatever the issues at stake are, we're going to have to know Homer. We're going to have to know who Oedipus is, right? If we want to study psychology in college, for crying out loud, and please don't. But if we want to do that, you got to know the Oedipus story, right? And so what I'm suggesting is that one reason to read the great books is to enter the great conversation. Another reason that we read the great books is a very similar reason to one of the reasons that we read the Bible. The same reason that I think the ancients wrote and read the great poems, the great books, and that's to offer a prevailing myth. By myth, I mean a system of ideas and beliefs and stories that sort of creates a structure to our thoughts, to our fundamental assumptions, to the way we think and do, to what we think a man ought to be and what we think a woman ought to be, to what we think heroes are and what we think villains are, right? All of that is sort of swimming under the surface of our consciousness. And how do we gain that consciousness? Well, it seeps in from everywhere, doesn't it? What do I think is beautiful in the world? Because of when I was born and when I grew up, I think that beautiful is somehow related to Cindy Crawford, right? I just can't escape it. And if all of that is coming our way, all of that is creating this myth that we live in the midst of. And so, if we want to fill, the mythological framework of our children with good things, then we read good books. Now, of course, that doesn't mean we have to buy into it all. But certainly, the great books give us material to for myth making, and this my next point is somewhat related. I think that we read the great books for the purpose of teaching what it means to be human in our particular way of being human. We take for granted what it means to be a human person. But if you grew up in Vietnam, or if you grew up in Central Africa, or even if you grew up in a country as Western as Japan, what it means to be human is a little something different than what it means for you or me to be human. And I want my children, I want our offspring to understand what it means to be human, not based on Hannah Montana or, Ariel. I want my children to understand what it means to be human, partially, not entirely, of course. What this talk is not called is Bring It, Don't Dumb It Down, How to Teach the Bible to a 12-year-old. Teach Bible too, but that's not what I'm talking about. But I do want Homer and Aeschylus and Boethius forming in my mind and in the mind of my students what it means to be human. And then another very sort of practical reason that we read good literature is because we want to offer it to our students as examples of good writing for them to imitate. I was talking to a very nice young lady at a a birthday party recently, and I was intrigued just listening to her from a distance. She was one of those who everyone at the party was listening to her from a distance, regardless of how near or far they were from her. I'm afraid I'm probably that same character at those parties, too. But nice lady, and I was hearing her talk about her her gifted education program that she teaches in public schools. I don't know. I just wanted to see what it was like. I was like, ooh, we fancy our kids at Trinitas as sort of gifted. Let me see what they do. And she was talking about teaching writing. No, not just writing, but she said, we're just given these goals, and we're allowed the freedom to meet these goals however we want to. So we may do a unit on advertising. We may do a unit on the Holocaust. We may do, and she just listed of, you know, you name it, teacher picks it. I think that's where the grist for the mill argument has sort of derailed. Yes, we need to teach the mill and to teach students to turn the mill, but I don't want my students reading whatever ad campaign they can find in Vogue magazine and writing a response to it. Granted, there's a time for that. I don't think that's a bad thing to do, but with my seventh graders, I want to put before them the best literature there is, so that they can imitate that style. They read advertising everywhere they go, for crying out loud. Come to class and do something good and different. I think that teaching dialectic, I think that we've got to realize that teaching dialectic, again, is only part of our goal. There is a great tradition. There is a great conversation. There are zillions of books that we want to read. So if we go back to the question, why would we teach a 12-year-old a classic? Well, have you seen the stack of books that we want them to read? We better get busy pretty soon, right? There's only so much time in life. So as soon as they can, let's put good books in their hand. And then, you know, reading these sorts of books, reading poetry, reading drama, it takes practice. It takes study, and it takes care. And I think that 12-year-olds are good at practicing things, or at least they're accustomed to being told to practice things. And then lastly, my last response to the question, why teach a 12-year-old a classic? For the enjoyment of it. I have so much fun in my class with my students, and I think for most of them, they have told me the same thing in very honest ways. They just love it. We just have fun. And that takes me back to what I said a moment ago. It's a human thing to read these books, to tell stories. If you were in Mrs. Wilson's talk this morning about storytelling, it's a human activity to tell stories and to love stories. We're entertained by them. That's why when you get together at parties, what do you do with one another? You have a drink and you tell stories together, right? What do you do with your wife on a Friday evening when you're pooped? You watch a movie. Somebody tells you a story, right? This storytelling, it's who we are. It's what it means to be human, because we're made in the image of God. It's fun. So I want to teach my students how to have fun reading stories. Read stories. Read good stories. Read the Iliad. All right, so that takes us to the second point of our outline, setting seventh grade goals. I picked seventh grade. I picked 12-year-olds because that's what I've spent more than most of my time teaching. But I'm sure you could apply this to sixth graders or eighth graders for that matter, and even some of it to 10th or 11th graders. But let's set some seventh grade goals. We need dialectic goals for dialectic students. And so, I mean, if there's any one thing that marks the dialectic stage, it's argument, right? So we need to set a goal of teaching our students how to argue. Dorothy Sayers, talks about a 12-year-old's natural tendency to argue. And that's very true, but a 12-year-old's argument goes something like this. Well, if they're talking about literature, I'm sorry. A 12-year-old's argument about literature goes something like this. I really like the way the princess looks at the prince when they, like, finally realize that they're in love. And so I think that's the climax of the story. And then the boy is like, that's the dumbest part. I skipped over that part. The climax of the story is when the guy finally gets killed at the end, and it talks about his entrails coming out onto the ground. That's the climax of the story. Like, 12-year-olds like to argue, sure, but they don't know how to argue, and they don't know what the point of arguing is. And so, so let's set good dialectic goals with our students. Teach them how to argue. So what does it mean to argue well? Before that, let's ask the question, why argue to begin with? Is the point of arguing to decide on a question like what's the best place of the story? No, that's not a good question for argument, right? But that's what 12-year-olds are going to argue about if you give them a book and you say, have an argument. The purpose of arguing is to find the truth. And I think that's really lost in our day. I think that the purpose of arguing in the public square especially has been to build one's own case or position, which may or may not be based on the truth. But I'd like to suggest that the purpose of arguing is to find the truth. And if that's really my goal when I enter into an argument, not to defend myself, not to build myself up, not to rub my opponent's nose into the ground, not to prove myself to be right because I'm always right. If none of those is my goal, but rather if finding the truth is my goal, what's going to be just as important as talking? Listening. That's right. It's going to be just as important to listen as it is to talk. And when you talk about debating, in our common language, your thoughts automatically go to like Fox News and CNN and the way they talk over each other and blah 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 blah. And that's how our students are trained by the world to argue. But that's not what it's about, right? Arguing is about finding the truth. That means it's about listening carefully, with generosity and patience, and then responding intelligently to whatever your interlocutor has said. So dialectic goals for dialectic students. Learn to argue. These are just examples of dialectic goals that you might take for yourself. I'm not listing an exhaustive list of dialectic goals. The next one might be tracing the cause and effect. Tracing the cause and effect, seeing relationships. When you read a story, when you look at a story, it comes to mind Aeschylus's Agamemnon. When you read a story like that, there's a lot that goes on the stage. Well, actually, now that I say it, there's actually a very little that goes on the stage. But what happens? Agamemnon, the great king, is killed by his wife. that's not something we run into every day, right? And so a good question here would be to ask why. Why does Clytemnestra kill Agamemnon? And there are answers to that question within the story of Agamemnon, within the play itself. There are answers to that question in the backstory, which is presented within the play. And then there are more answers to that question in the backstory that we know from other myths, poems, and plays that aren't necessarily included in the play itself. And so my point here is not just to talk about Agamemnon, but rather to say a good dialectical goal is to trace effects to their causes, to ask why did this happen. And then a third dialectical goal that I think is really important, and I'll talk a little more about it later, is to recognize the relationships between different stories or different works of literature that you read. Listening to Bauckham just a few minutes ago, and the way that he dealt with the text of the Bible, I really, really appreciated the way that he dealt with the text of the Bible, the way that he doesn't see in isolation the creation story and then the flood story and then the crucifixion and resurrection story. He doesn't see these in isolation. I very well could be wrong, and I'm not arguing for this, but maybe a grammatical way of reading several different stories is to take each one of them on their own terms. But I think a dialectical way of reading several different stories is to make the connections between them. And so if you're reading the Bible, do with the Bible what Bauckham did a while ago, and draw the or don't draw it for them, but have your students trace the relationships between the stories. And so if you're reading, let's say if you follow a path through Greek literature, and you read the Iliad, and then you read the Odyssey, let's say you throw the Aeneid in there just because it's, based on the same story, and then you read Herodotus, and then you read several tragedies and maybe a comedy or something in the end of the year, that might be a little ambitious. It probably is a little ambitious, but let's say you do all that. When you read the Odyssey, you've got the Iliad behind you. It's very, very, very important that you don't close the book on the Iliad. It's very important, I would say even, that you keep the text of the book itself somewhere on the shelf, so that when you get to the Aeneid and you read about Aeneas's shield, you can pull the Iliad off the shelf and go back and reread Achilles' shield. Did I say Aeneas' shield in the Aeneid? Did I say the right thing? But go back and read about the construction of Achilles' shield in the Iliad, and trace the lines from one to another. How are they alike? How are they different? Certainly Virgil had Homer in mind, and how can we read Virgil if we don't keep Homer in mind? More importantly, why are we even teaching them in the same year if they don't have something to do with one another? We're saying they have something to do with one another just by putting them in a class together, right? But does that mean your 12-year-old is going to get that? Does that mean your 12-year-old is going to keep Homer in his mind when he's reading Virgil? No, you've got to do it yourself. You've got to pull it back off the shelf. You've got to bring it back to mind. You've got to say, when you read about Achilles' shield, mark this with a tab in your notes, because when we get to Aeneas, 3, 6, 4 months later, we're going to have to come back and read this, and I want you to know what you wrote in your notes here, be able to find it easily. So that's a way to set your students up to be able to do that very dialectical thing of tracing lines between the different stories that you read. And then a second point that I want to make under your heading, setting seventh grade goals. Yes, seventh graders, I suppose, well, I don't suppose these divisions are really that technical anyway, but in our school, seventh grade is technically into the logic school. But truth be told, you've got some seventh graders who are very much grammatical students, right? And the ones who have made that leap mentally into dialectic, they're fresh and new to it, and they still need a lot of grammar help. So don't set aside grammar stage goals just because you are in the dialectic stage now. You can't assume that they pick up on all the grammar. You still have to teach it. So this means when you read book one of The Odyssey, it means you need to read through in advance, and you need to make a list of vocabulary words for your student out of that book. And you need to teach them those vocabulary words, and you need to do analogies on the board with those vocabulary words, and you need to have them incorporate those vocabulary words into the paragraphs that you're writing in your writing section. And that way, when they read those vocabulary words, they've already, in the Odyssey, they've already done the grammar work of understanding the terms, and then when they read it, they actually have the capacity to achieve it. And I suppose this is what I mean by bring it, don't dumb it down. Maybe the better way to say it would be bring them up to the top of the mountain. If you're going to be reading big words in the Odyssey, teach them the big words. Don't find some sort of junky paraphrase just so that they can read the Odyssey. Take them up to the mountain. They can do it. They can learn these vocabulary words. And then don't forget everything that that the grammar stage teachers are doing. They're making lists of things for their students to memorize. So as you go, keep character lists on the board in their notebooks. Have your students, you know, keep a list of the gods and where they appear in this particular story and what they do and who's on the Trojan side and who's on the Achaean side. Keep a list of that. Gods, men, Achaeans, Trojans. Keep lists. Memorize those lists. Study those lists. Odysseus is going on his wanderings. Aeneas is going around burning places down because he can. Keep lists of all of these things and have the students learn them. Don't just assume they know them because you read them in the book. All right, on to the next section of the outline. Unless there's a question or comment I would love to take, now would be a nice place to pause. Okay, on we go. The how-to. And again, I remind you, these are just lessons that I've learned from teaching my class. They aren't written in anyone's Bible, especially mine. Equip your students with everything they'll need to climb the mountain, and then climb the mountain with them. The first thing that I say here is that you ought to read together. I don't know what your time constraints are. I don't know what your what sort of requirements your board has given you about how much you need to read in a year. But I think the best way to teach 12-year-olds classics is by reading aloud together. Read aloud together. Here's how I do it in my classroom. I arrange students. We actually have these nice couches. Well, they were nice at one time. But we actually have these nice couches, and they sit in a horseshoe shape. And I sit at the front, and I have a little stool that I sit in this crazy Native American style that they don't understand how I balance up there. But I do. And they're facing one another. That's really hard for a 12-year-old, right? It's really hard for two 12-year-olds to look at each other and not make faces and pick noses and do all sorts of other things. Notice I didn't say pick a nose. So here comes equipping them with the responsibility that's necessary to do what you're asking them to do. If we're going to read together, if we're going to talk together, we don't need a lot of this in the classroom. You know what I mean? Turning around, looking. You remember this from your college English class, right? There's always turning around and looking to see what someone's saying. And then, I mean, there are temptations to avoid there, too. I mean, when someone's talking from the back of the room and you're sitting at the front of the room thinking, gosh, what an idiot, and you're rolling your eyes, right? So at least with this horseshoe shape, they've got some accountability. But, too, I mean, they might still roll their eyes at one another. So you've got to train through that and teach through that. But you really can't. Can do it. They really can grow up a lot. So another reason that I like to, or a reason that I like to read together, is because for seventh graders, the range of comprehension ability is really broad. You've got some students maybe who are new to your school who just have trouble making a lick of sense out of anything you read. And then there are other students who are like reading books ahead in the Iliad, and you've got this broad range, and as you've got to move through this material as a community, as a unit. That's why we think that school is a good thing. Homeschooling is good, but school offers us community, right? It offers us people. And so if you really believe that there's something to this community, face each other. It's like, you know, some churches I've been in that have horseshoe-shaped congregations. And when you take communion and you look around and you see the other people, you realize you're God's people doing this together, it really helps. It really helps to recognize that you're doing this together rather than just looking at the back of another head. So face each other, do it in community, and read aloud so that this broad range of comprehension ability is going to stay in a place together doing the same thing. There are a couple of problems I see with silent reading at home. First of all, you've got some who probably just won't do it. That's unfortunate. Maybe your school is full of saints, but probably not. And then some will do it and work really hard at it, but they just won't get it. And so you'll come to school and you'll think, or they'll come to, yeah, you'll come to school and you'll think, we're going to have this great literary conversation, and you'll throw out this great question like, what is the central theme of book 7 of Homer's Iliad? And you'll get this: I don't know. What's the theme? You never know what they're going to get and what's going to come back to you when you send them home and do work. Now, 11th, 12th graders, it's a little different story, but 7th graders, it's not a different story. Students haven't been trained yet to do two essential tasks for reading the classics. One, they haven't been trained well to interpret poetic language. It really is hard to read poetry, especially this kind of epic poetry that we read, and it takes training. That's why they're in your class. That's hard to do on your own, and you need to offer them the teaching, the training in the milieu. They need to hear how you read out loud, how you emphasize the subject and the verb of the sentence, and everything else is just fluff, really important fluff. But if you need to know what this sentence means, you need to look for the subject and the verb, right? That's what this sentence is about. They need to hear the inflection in your voice. They need to hear the drama that you can offer to them by reading them. It all helps. I really don't mean to toot my own horn, but a couple of times this past year when I unfortunately had to be away from my precious ones, I had substitutes, very competent, wonderful people. One of them is actually in the room, and I'm not talking about him. But when I came back, they were like, Mr. Hughes, please don't go anymore. Please stay. It's so wonderful when you read to us. Why? Because I take the time to read slowly, to emphasize what needs to be emphasized, and they get it. If they're doing that in their head at home, and they're 12, they're not going to. So offer them that help. Give them the help that they need to do what you want them to do, and they will love you for it. They'll be really proud of themselves, and they really did get it with your help, and they have something to be proud of. So they haven't been taught to read poetic language. And then another thing that they may or may not be good at yet is retaining overnight information they gained through reading at home. That is another task. That's something else, to read something and then to go to bed and then to get up and go to school and still have access to it. That's a skill. And for some people it comes very naturally, for others it doesn't. And I don't think that you ought to assume that your 12th graders have already acquired that, your 12-year-olds. I don't think you can assume that your 12-year-olds have acquired that skill. However, I've told you that I like to read aloud to them in class, and some people have asked me before, well, why don't you let them read out loud in class? There are some basic problems with the students reading aloud in class. Seventh graders almost always read either too fast or too slow, one or the other. You've got seventh graders who have really flashy reading skills. You know, they were the ones who were reading Jane Austen before they went to kindergarten and that sort of thing. And they want to show everybody how good they can read. And reading well means reading really fast, right? And nobody gets it. I don't even get it. I'm like, what? Back that thing up. And then you've got the other kid who, you know, open the Iliad, and it's the anger of, what's that word? Peleus, son, what's that word? Try it. That's not poetry, is it? No, if we're going to really have this enjoyable poetic experience in class, and yes, that's part of class, we can't read it like that, okay? It's like going to a play and every fifth line the actor says, line please, you just lose it, okay? So seventh graders either read too fast or too slow and you lose a lot. Another reason I think it's good to read together is just, again, I mentioned it just now, but this experience of enjoying, it's fun to read aloud. If you were at Mrs. Wilson's talk, she talked about how all three of her kids would be lined up on Pastor Wilson's belly, I guess, and he would be reading Narnia to them over and over again. Why? 'Cause it's fun. We really enjoy reading together, and school ought to be fun if it can be. Granted, sometimes it can't be, but when it can be, it should be. So what are the drawbacks of reading aloud, of teacher reading aloud in class? One, it's really, really time consuming. It takes time to read out loud, and then it takes time to stop and explain the things that are hard. Well, that's a problem you're going to have to deal with. I'm sorry. I get 2 hours a day for the class that I teach 5 days a week. And that's a pretty fair amount of time, and I'm very grateful for it. I could probably take four if I could have it, but they've got to learn other things. And so it might not be an option for you, because you might be given an hour a day and you might be given this list, of books. Well, I would say narrow. Get permission from your administration or your board if you need to drop books off the list if you have to, or to have the option of reading selections from a book. Now, I am all in favor of reading whole texts. Yes, read whole texts, but sometimes it's better to read at least part of one than none of one, right? So, for example, Herodotus's histories, my purpose is in teaching 12-year-olds Herodotus's histories is not so much necessarily to introduce them to the idea of historical scholarship, and this is the beginning of it. Maybe in your, theory of historical practice or something like that class in college, you might do that. But I want my kids to know about the Persian War, right? And Herodotus covers that in books 7, 8, and 9. All that other stuff at the beginning, traveling around in Egypt, folks eating crazy stuff, dressing crazy ways, that's really cool. I like it a lot, and we could have a lot of fun reading it in class. But if I need to cut something, I cut that. I do, and I'm not ashamed of it. It might not be. It might take some creativity, I guess, is my point. It might take some creativity with your schedule, with your book list, with your reading selections, to be able to read aloud in class to 12-year-olds. But I think it's very good, very worth it. Enter into the dialogue with your superiors and see what you guys can come up with that works for your goals of your school and in your classroom. So what are some drawbacks? It's time consuming. And then the other objection that I've heard is that, well, you're saying, Justin, that your students aren't able to read aloud very well. Well, if you don't let them read aloud, they never will be able to read aloud. Have you heard of a place called home? Have your students reading good books aloud to their parents. We have, if you went to Mrs. Trotter's talk this morning, we have a program at our school called Boni Libri, where students are reading good books at grade level, whereas the Iliad, I suppose, is something above grade level. But they're reading good books at grade level at home as, you know, a more traditional sort of literature. We don't do extra things with them in class. They just have to read them and write a little report on them. They can practice that at home, right? Education does not have to and should not happen entirely in the classroom. Parents, if your children can't read aloud, that's something you can do. You don't need to pay me, even if it is peanuts. You don't need to pay me to do that. All right, carrying on to talking together is the next point on your outline, talking together. Ask good questions of your students. That is, avoid asking trivia. Ask them questions. And by saying avoid asking trivia, I don't mean avoid asking details. Ask them about the details, but ask them about details that matter. Also, avoid asking questions that could be answered without any knowledge or reference to the material. So you might say, what do you think the most important idea in the Iliad is? Honor. That's right. The kid answered my question, didn't he? But does he have to know anything? Has he had to understand any of the Iliad to get it? No. Ask him questions that require him to interact with the material. So ask him a question like, what makes Achilles upset at the very beginning of the story? Honor. Well, what about the honor? And then he can go into the details. He has to reference. He has to have access to the material. Ask those sorts of questions of your students, both in class when you're talking and then on your tests also. Bad question. Do you think Aeneas ever really loved Dido? That doesn't require you to access the material, and you can't really prove that even if you do have access to the material. Good question instead. How does the Bible define love? Well, here, really access the material. Don't let them say, I think somewhere in the Bible it says that love suffers long. Well, where in the Bible does it say that love suffers long? Because you know what I'm talking about. Kids will make up stuff that they think is in the Bible. And adults will too. So ask them a question like this. How does the Bible define love? And if they can't answer it, I mean, have an answer in your back pocket. All right, guys, let's open to 1 Corinthians 13 or whatever, John 1 or 1 John or whatever you want to open up to and look at what the Bible says about love. And then ask this question. Remember, the question that we don't want to ask, do you think Aeneas really ever loved Dido? Don't ask that question. Instead say, does either Aeneas' love for Dido or Dido's love for Aeneas fit this description that we've just read about in the Bible? It's harder as a teacher to ask that kind of question. It takes more forethought, it takes more planning, and it takes you to have access to more than just the Aeneid. It means you got to know the Bible too, right? But if we don't want these wishy-washy, well, I sort of feel that Aeneas really loved Dido because she was probably very pretty, because after all, she was a queen. And why would he not love a queen? What are you talking about? The book doesn't deal with that at all. You know, tell me what the Bible says about love, and then give me evidence. Aeneas does this, and he does this, and he does this, which matches what the Bible says, or which is absolutely the opposite of what the Bible is. Whatever it is, make them tell you concrete things. Come down, Plato, down to the world. Deal in concrete, material things that actually happen, not in ideas like your English class in college taught you to do, which was terrible, by the way. Another bad question. Do you think you would have killed Agamemnon had you been in Clytemnestra's place? it doesn't matter. It doesn't. And it doesn't bring your students back into contact with the material. And that's the purpose of asking these questions. Get them back into contact with the material so that they're really learning it, and then get them to think about the material. But what would you do doesn't matter. We want to know WWAD. What would Agamemnon do, right? So instead, ask a question like this. Was the death of Agamemnon justifiable? Well, here's what's hard about as a teacher asking that question. Your students probably have some cooked up idea about what justice is, which probably isn't going to work. So if you're going to ask a question like that, you're going to have some sort of standard for justice. You've got to put the ruler in their hand. You can't expect them to know it. So, I mean, even if you make it up yourself, you can say, you know, for our purposes in this class today, we're going to call justice A, B, C, and D. According to that standard, is Agamemnon's death justifiable? Now, if you want to be like a super teacher and take up a ton of time, you can like pull some just idea of justice from Augustine or something like that and be all integrative and whatnot. And that's also very good. And thank you for being that kind of teacher. But if you want to accomplish your goal of having them come into contact with the material, answer the question according to some fixed standard, and give some sort of good reason. This'll do. This'll work, right? You don't have to be super teacher, but also don't be the kind of teacher who says, "Would you have killed Agamemnon?" Another point about talking together, I mentioned the kinds of questions you ask your students, but I want you to teach your students, I mean, you can do it if you want to. I said, I want you to, as if I'm your boss, give me a break. I think that you could, I suggest that you, teach students to ask, good questions of the literature. So, you're gonna have students asking dumb questions, and you don't have to hurt their feelings. You don't have to say, you know, that was a dumb question. But what you do need to do is give them good examples, good models of questions. And when somebody asks a really good question, I had this kid in my class last year, Zachary, who had a bit of a speech impediment, and at the beginning of the year I could tell that he was sort of the outsider of the class, but he was super smart. Oh my goodness. Like, this is the kind of kid who you want in your college class, we're reading the Iliad, and he's like reading the editor's introduction at the beginning of the book that we didn't read in class, and he's like finding articles about the Iliad to read, and he raises his hand and says, so and so says such and such about the Iliad, and I'm like, really? You've read him? That's cool. Tell me more. But anyway, when When you have questions like Zachary asks these really good probing questions, jump up and down about it. Bring attention to it. Show this student the place of honor in your classroom. Show everybody else this is what you want to be like. A long time ago, and I suppose he probably still gives the talk, I heard Matt Whitling talk about the same sort of idea with respect to the scoffer, the wise student and the naive student. And I'm probably messing him all up, but the important thing to do for the naive student is to show that the scoffer is a fool and to show the wise to be truly wise, and then those naive ones will follow the wise one because you've endorsed it. And so I want to do in my class the same sort of thing with all sorts of things, not just behavior, attitude, but also with the kinds of questions we ask of the literature. So when Zachary asks a really good question, I say, stop. Did everybody hear that? Zachary, ask your question again. And he asks, and I say, anybody have any ideas? Don't just jump into it. Let them simmer in his question a little bit. Anybody have any ideas? They'll think. They're on the spot now. And you hope that they haven't just zoned out. I don't think they have. If you're being this super teacher that you are, they probably haven't zoned out. So praise good questions when you hear good questions. So what is a good question? Good questions are questions that can be answered with reference to the text that you've read, or with a secondary source, or simply by reasoning through the actual given facts. So you can answer a question by looking back in the book to answer it, or you can look up some secondary source, whether it be an essay or a commentary or something like that, or a question that you can just reason through to come to a good answer. Inappropriate questions are questions that can be answered only by conjecture. Seventh graders are great at coming up with questions like these. Here is one example of a seventh grade question. Mr. Hughes, one translation calls the tapestry that Clytemnestra spreads below Agamemnon's feet vermilion, and another one calls it purple. Do you think the tapestry was red or purple? I don't know. And I don't care either. Does it matter? Like, what's the point of the tapestry? It's a symbol for entrapment, right? It's the blood that's running out of the house. Is blood red sometimes? Is it purple sometimes? Who cares? That's not a good question. And again, I encourage you, I'm being sort of sassy right now, but I encourage you to be very kind to your students about this and say, I'm glad you're thinking about it, but that's not a great question. Let me tell you why. The purpose of the tapestry is this, this, and this, and we can understand that without knowing whether it was really vermilion or purple. So let's just not ask that question. And I say this because, like, you only have your hour or your 2 hours or whatever, and you don't have time to chase these rabbits of insignificant questions. So you've really got to teach them to use your time well, and you've got to be disciplined enough yourself to recognize one of those questions that's going to waste your time and carry on. Anybody know what time I'm supposed to let you go? Woo! One last word on questions, and this will I refer again here to Matt Whitling. I don't remember, and he might not even have said it, but I feel like I heard it on some ACCS lecture from a long time ago, when I was a mere youth. I think he was talking about writing. I don't remember what the context was. Anyway, I tell my students, and I think I got the idea from Matt Willing sometime, to keep a question box, not like a literal box, but a box in your mind of questions. And there will be some questions that your students ask in class that are really good questions, but you either don't have time to answer it in class, or you yourself don't have the resources to answer it. Like it could be answered with a proper scholarship, but you haven't read that essay or that article, or you haven't thought about it enough, or it's outside of your goals for the class that day. Tell your students to keep a question box and say, that's a great question. Put it in your question box, and one day you'll hear somebody smarter than me sometime down the road talking about this book, and they'll probably answer it. If you keep it at the front of your mind, that question will be answered, or one day you can write your dissertation on it. Keep a question box. I'm gonna skip over studying together. I do think it's good to teach your students how to study, especially in the seventh grade when you're requiring things of them that haven't been required of them before. We've read 250 pages of the Iliad, and you expect my son to come in and take your test and know everything that he's ever known, that you've ever taught him? No, but I taught him how to study in class. So teach your students how to study. This is a new thing that they're doing. Help them with it. And then do other things with your students together. Look for activities and fun things. Now, when I was in high school, junior high, I hated more than anything a group project. Why? Because you or I or somebody else was the one who was going to do it all, and the rest of them were going to get your good grade. So please don't be a teacher who assigns that sort of thing. But do fun projects that again bring your students back into connection, back into contact with the material. Don't do stuff just to be doing stuff. Something that I do with my class at the end of the year, after we've read the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid, we have a funeral game event, and I usually do it in the last week of school when all the other teachers are tempted to take their kids outside anyway and shoot hoops. Well, let's go outside and let's throw a javelin and let's throw a pig iron and let's have a foot race and a chariot race and let's burn somebody. Ma'am? Oh, yeah, pull, yeah. Do fun stuff that actually matters, and that's going to build this community that I mentioned before. A note on projects and activities. A good teacher can make the worst project really good, and a bad teacher can make the best project really bad. Be a good teacher. Put the planning and the care into doing whatever it is you're doing. Don't assign a research project so that you can catch up on grading. If you assign a research project that students are going to be working on independently, help your students. Be over their shoulder, beside them all the time. You're always, 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 always teaching them. This isn't a break. However, if you think of it as a break, your students are going to produce junk, and you're going to be disappointed and angry because they didn't do what you expected them to do. Well, it's your fault because you didn't help them, dear. Okay? Get on the ball. Be a good teacher and make your project good. Do it with all your heart. A couple of things of how not to when you're teaching classics to seventh graders. I think, and I've briefly mentioned this, a lot of teachers are tempted to expect their seventh grade class to be like their freshman college class was, just because we read the Iliad in my freshman English class, and we're reading the Iliad in the seventh grade, so it's going to be the same. Nope. It's going to be very different. So don't come in with a list of discussion topics and throw them out there and expect the class to go from there. It's not going to happen. It takes help. It takes work. It takes teaching at every step of the way. Your freshman English teacher in college assumed that you had already had that, whether you had or not. But this is the time for students to learn to do that sort of conversation. Um, Oh, don't be tempted to think that you have to exhaust everything there is to teach about a given subject or book. How many books have been written about the Iliad? There are endless things to say about the Iliad, right? You've got to select something. You can't teach them everything there is to teach them about the Iliad. The weight of the world is not on you. Somebody else one day will teach them about the Iliad. And if you've done a good job of making sure your 12-year-old knows the characters and the story and the main themes, then the next time they have a really good teacher when they're in 11th grade and they read it again, or 12th grade or college, they're going to understand it that much more because you did a good job in the 7th grade making sure they mastered the book itself. And then another thing that I would caution you to be very careful about, and again, this is my contrarianism coming out, and I mean this with all love and respect, but be careful about getting caught up in teaching a Christian worldview. Teach your students the Bible, or have the Bible class, or bring the Bible into your curriculum, and teach your students the Bible, and teach your students to think like the Bible thinks. But be careful not to to say, we're Christians, and so we think that A, B, and C is wrong, and therefore we can look at Aeneas' character and say that he was wrong for this, this, and this. Teach your students to go to the Bible and think according to biblical language, biblical thought, not this vague, nebulous Christian worldview. That's when they start saying things like, I think somewhere in the Bible it says that we're supposed to vote for Republicans, because that's the milieu that they're living in, and anything that comes down from my parents or teachers is from the Bible. No, teach them what's in the Bible, and then they can decide who to vote for themselves and all that good stuff. A couple of practical suggestions before I release you into the wild. Choose good teachers. If you're an administrator or a board who is hiring someone to teach a class like the one I've been describing, choose someone who is really good. And again, here I refer to Mrs. Wilson this morning. She said something like, interested makes interesting. And I totally buy into that. I think that people who are interested in the world around them are going to be interesting people to listen to. And so if you've got somebody who applies to teach your job and you say, you know, what do you like to read? I just love the Iliad. I read it all the time. Anything else? I just love the Iliad. I want to teach the Iliad because I love it so much. Get interested in the world out there, right? And when you're interested in the world, when you're reading things and when you're curious about this and that and the other, your students are going to find you fascinating. And if your students think you're fascinating because you're interested in this and that and you're always talking to them about it at lunch, then they're gonna dig everything you say. And then my last practical suggestion is to take the task lightly. Have fun. Enjoy. Laugh, laugh, laugh. Laugh at yourself. Laugh at Plato. God knows we can. Laugh at Homer. Laugh at Aeschylus. Laugh at yourself again and yourself again. Laugh at your students when they do funny things. And then laugh at yourself again. Laugh. We really have so much fun in my class, and it's because we just laugh a lot. Look for the funny things and laugh at them. Don't be stoic school marm. Be really fun teacher. It's not that hard. Just have fun. You like to have fun, right? And you don't want to teach your students that it's bad to have fun. So laugh and enjoy your class. I'm sorry I've kept you a couple of minutes late. I'd love to chat with you later. Thank you very much.